This is VOA News. The head of Iran's civilian nuclear program has called Sunday's blackout at a nuclear facility nuclear terrorism. The blackout struck the country's Natanz nuclear facility. Ali Akbar Saleh made the comments in a report published online by Iranian state television Sunday night. He did not name a suspect in the sabotage. His comments currently escalate Mideast tensions. Many Israeli media outlets offered the same assessment that a cyber attack darkened Natanz and damaged a facility that is home to sensitive centrifuges. While the reports offered no sourcing for the evaluation, Israeli media maintains a close relationship with the country's military and intelligence agencies. 82 people killed in one day and in one city in Myanmar. Reports from Myanmar say this is yet another crackdown by security forces on pro-democracy protesters. Friday's death toll in Bago is the biggest in a day and single city since March 14th, when just over 100 people were killed in Yangon. Libyan Prime Minister Abdelhamid Dbeibeh and a delegation of ministers will make their first visit to Turkey since taking office last month. The Turkish presidency said the visit will happen Monday. Libya's new unity government was sworn in on March 15th from two warring administrations that had ruled eastern and western regions, completing a smooth transition of power after a decade of violent chaos. Turkey had backed the Tripoli-based government of national accord against the eastern-based Libyan National Army, which was supported by Russia, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and France. This is VOA News. The last few people remaining in the area closest to an erupting volcano on the Caribbean island of St. Vincent have raced to get clear. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
The final evacuees made their way to safety a day after the La Soufrière volcano erupted with an explosion that shook the ground, spewed ash skyward, and blanketed the island in a layer of fine volcanic rock. The eruption is its first large one since 1979. Ash covered everything, creeping into homes, cars, and noses, and a strong sulfur smell lingered in the air. Evacuee Tawana Burke says she's hoping the eruption will end soon.
I am scared. I'm just hoping for the best, so that everything can be over, so I can go back home.
Local resident Verena Hillock says she's been through this before.
The first time it erupted, I was 9 years old. Now I'm 50 years old.
Scientists warn that the explosions could continue for days or even weeks, and that the worst could be yet to come. I'm Karen Chamas.
Jordan's Prince Hamza made his first public appearance since he was placed under house arrest last week. Hamza attended a celebration with King Abdullah II Sunday in what appeared to be an attempted show of unity on a major Jordanian holiday. But it remained unclear whether the king and his popular half-brother had reconciled since their public rift last week that saw Hamza placed under a form of house arrest. This after accusations that he was involved in a malicious plot to destabilize the kingdom. In statements leaked to the media, Hamza has denied the accusations. Voters are casting ballots in the tiny West African nation of Benin. The election comes following a series of violent demonstrations over the past week. Incumbent President Patrice Talon is seeking re-election, despite earlier pledges that he would only serve one term. Talon is facing two challengers in Sunday's vote, though critics say that the top opposition candidates were blocked from taking part. Ecuadorians are voting Sunday in a runoff election to choose between a right-wing and left-wing candidate to replace President Lenin Moreno. Moreno is not seeking re-election. Polls show the two contenders in a tight race. Economist Andres Arroz from the Union of Hope Coalition was leading in the first round of a vote in February. Also running, former banker Guillermo Lasso, a conservative politician and third-time presidential candidate who has finished second twice before in 2013 and 2017. We have more international headlines for you on voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Liz Palka, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
When all the opposition leaders have been exiled or put in jail, I don't think this election is credible. And like I told you before, for an election to be really credible, the most important thing is that the election has to be inclusive.
Beninese choose a new president Sunday despite opposition protest.
To know how they're going to make their ends meet right now, because many of these people have been left homeless. They're still on the streets. They're still without jobs. They're still without a loving family member who, in many cases, was the breadwinner for their home.
Victims of an explosion at an Equatorial Guinea military camp demand compensation from the government.
So it is very important to start encouraging, having platforms where we share, where we listen to what the young people are saying, especially in this IT sector. There are so many IT entrepreneurs today in Lesotho. So data is very important.
And the Lesotho Minister for Small Business, Cooperatives and Marketing presents a budget to Parliament. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Benin, opposition groups say Sunday's presidential election is not credible. This following a heavy deployment by the military in parts of the country, including the capital Cotonou, before the election. The government deployed the military following violent protests against the incumbent president Patrice Talon. The protesters say the president's official term ended on April 5, making Sunday's poll illegal. But supporters of the president reject the criticisms. They blame Beninese in the diaspora for fomenting trouble to undermine the president and erode his popularity before the election. They, however, say the president will win re-election despite the opposition group's efforts against him. Haruna Omar is a former Benin ambassador to the United States. He tells me that the heavy deployment of the military significantly undermines the integrity of the election. He also says President Talon's anticipated victory will lack legitimacy in the eyes of the people and the international community.
From my point of view, the basic tenets for a credible election are missing in this election. The most fundamental principle defining credible election is that they must reflect the free expression of the will of the people. Now, the opposition candidates have been excluded from the race. To that effect as well, the country seemed to be split in half between the north and the south, just because of the protests, and the army is everywhere in the city. As of noon today, while the people are voting, there's a very sparse voters. People are not coming out. People are very, tentative in their approach. In some certain part of the country, there were not even voting apparatus that was deployed, because those areas are not accessible to the poll workers. That's exactly the situation in Benin as we speak.
But Ambassador Haruna, you said the country is divided because of the protests. But some Beninois are saying that you and former President Yair Boni and his supporters are to blame for the disunity in the country, because those of you in the diaspora are paying people to undermine the country's unity and threaten its territorial integrity. How do you respond to such criticism?
I think these accusations are very bogus. On April 5th, Talon came to the end of his constitutional mandate. So spontaneously, people went on the street to protest, which is, as you know, in any democracy, civil disobedience is a part of the democratic process. So based on that, the fact that President Talon have excluded all his opponents from the race, and people such as Ricky Amadugu have been taken as a hostage and jailed by the government. Many such as Kwame Kuche, Sebastian Ajavon have been exiled and banned from running. Therefore, the overwhelming majority of the population can vote for the candidate of their choice. So obviously, those frustrations came to a point where people decided that they will basically protest.
But some people are suggesting that President Talon indeed has two opponents who are challenging him for the presidency, challenging his re-election bid.
This is a sham of election, Peter. Those two people were selected, handpicked, and funded and financed by Talon himself. He was thinking that by doing that, having people to run against me that I have selected, those people will give me some kind of that this election is legitimate. But the country and the population realized that this is a sham of election, and that's why people are saying that they were not, this election is not challenging, this election is not a competitive election. He wanted to handpick the weakest element in a country to run against him so he can show himself up.
I understand you called on the international community, including the African Union, but some supporters of the government are saying that, you know, calling for international intervention is basically mortgaging the sovereignty of Benin. And as a top diplomat, they said you should not be engaging in such act of sabotage in calling on the international community to intervene in the domestic affairs of Benin. How do you respond to that?
The world is a global village. And as we speak, the law enable people in the country where they cannot get their voice heard to call on international community to intervene. Listen, Benin is still a small country, a poor country, and we depend on our partner for our development. If in a community where you cannot, your leader are not listening to you, and the country is on the verge of a civil war, only thing you do, you call the international community, you call the people that you can rely on to come and prevent this to happen by engaging effectively the government.
The Electoral Commission in Benin is saying today's presidential election is going to be organized in a free, transparent, and credible manner. What are your thoughts about it?
I think this is ridiculous. How can you talk about an election that will be organized in a transparent manner when you have army on the street? When the head of the SENA, which is the Electoral Commission, is being housed at the military barrack with his people to oversee the election. How can you say that an election is being conducted in a transparent manner and a credible manner when all the opposition leaders have been exiled or put in jail? I don't think this election is credible. And like I told you before, for an election to be really credible, the most important thing is that the election has to be inclusive.
Haruna Omar is a former Benin ambassador to the United States. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. Equatorial Guinea, victims of the recent explosion at a military camp have yet to receive compensation, according to Equatorial Guinea Justice, a civil society group. The U.S.-based civil society group also says the government in Malabo appears disinterested in the well-being of the victims of the explosion, an accusation supporters of the administration deny. This after several rights groups, including Human Rights Watch, urged the government to invite international experts to independently investigate circumstances that led to the explosion on March 7. The explosion took place at the military camp in Bata, the country's largest city. Officials say the blast left at least 98 people dead and 615 injured. But civil society groups and opponents of the administration dispute the official figures. Tutu Alicante is the executive director of Equatorial Guinea Justice. He tells me that domestic partners of Equatorial Guinea should pressure the administration to compensate the victims of the explosion.
We should know clearly what the government intends to do on behalf of the victims and on behalf of the surviving family members. None of this information has been known, and this is the type of information that should be known within weeks, or within days, right? So we're asking for that basic level of governance that any citizen should be able to expect from their government, and that has not happened here.
But Tutu, some people are suggesting that the authorities are in the process of investigating the circumstances that led to the explosions and the aftermath thereof. So you should give
the administration or the authorities enough time to complete this task before addressing some of these concerns you raised. How do you react to that?
A couple of things that we know so far, you know, that Teodorin, the vice minister in charge of defense and in charge of national security, who should be the first one to come here and give explanations, have already publicly said that no one should expect any compensation as a result of what happened here, because what happened was an accident. Basically trying to absolve the government from any responsibility, any liability. By claiming this is an accident, what they're trying to say, you know, is that there was no fault. Regardless of whether it's an accident or not, which we should know what caused this tragedy, there can still be fault. There can still be legal liability. And that is not something that should take month and month, because what they're trying to do, you know, is turn the page by claiming it's an accident, claiming no one is at fault, claiming the government will give people aid and not compensation.
Well, some people are saying that your call, coupled with other pressures being brought from outside the country, are unlikely to have any significant impact on the ground. Do you agree to such an assessment by skeptics?
So it should not surprise no one that a highly repressive, highly authoritarian regime would ignore the calls for justice, would ignore the calls for transparency by civil society organizations. There is a reason why Equatorial AG Justice, the organization that I direct, is not in Equatorial Guinea. There is a reason why I'm in exile, right? So the fact that Teodorin or his father would not listen to what I have to say should not come as a surprise. That, however, should not mean that the international community, the UN, the African Union, and countries that have a diplomatic relationship with Equatorial Guinea should not be flexing their diplomatic muscles and their business muscles to demand for some basic dignity for the people that have been affected here.
So what is your next line of action in terms of strategy in this call that you're making to the authorities in Equatorial Guinea?
Again, knowing the type of intransigent government that we'll deal with, in a government that does not respect the rule of law, we are still committed as Equatorial Guineans to use the systems available to us inside the country. We have a commission of juries right now who will be sending letters to the Attorney General demanding they investigate and they be transparent as to what happened here and how people should expect to be compensated for the loss that they have suffered. Addition to that, you know, we're reaching out to the victims themselves because the victims deserve a recognition and representation of what happened here. And we hope to bring their cases once we have a significant number of victims inside the country, as well as to the African Commission and international bodies. And beyond that, I mean, I think one of the things that have recognizing that we're dealing with a dictatorship, longest serving head of state in the world, one of the things that we're committed to, you know, is working with Equatorial Guineans to bring about peaceful transition in Equatorial Guinea. The same type of transition that, you know, we have seen in places like Egypt, in Tunisia, most recently in places like Senegal and other places, to tell these dictators that their time is up and it's time for new leadership to come to place.
Tutu, some people are rejecting your call for the victims to be compensated purely because they think this is a highly disguised initiative from your organization seeking to overthrow the administration in the country at the moment. How do you react to such a reaction from supporters of the government?
So I would not be surprised that, you know, people that benefit from the status quo would be opposed to anything that seeks to challenge that grab, that hegemonic power grab that they have onto power, right? That should not surprise anyone. And to say that the victims themselves do not want compensation, that's completely missing the ball. There are many people in Equatorial Guinea today, and you can hear this on audios, they go viral on WhatsApp, that are still asking to see their dead ones, because among the 98, I think it was 98, that the government claimed were the ones that died, there are still many people out there saying, I still have not seen my child, I still have not seen my husband or my wife, right? And these people, you know, need closure. They need closure in terms of seeing their family, and they need to know how they're going to make their ends meet right now, because many of these people have been left homeless. They're still on the streets. They're still without jobs. They're still without a loving family member who, in many cases, was the bread earner for their home. And those people are the ones on whose behalf I'm working. I'm not necessarily working on behalf of someone that supports the regime and wants to continue with the status quo.
Tutu Alicante is the executive director of Equatorial Guinea Justice. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. In Lesotho, the Minister for Small Business, Cooperatives and Marketing presented a budget to Parliament Friday. Thesele Maseribani says he seeks funds to help empower the country's youth. He also says students who have been unable to continue their education will be trained in life skills, including information technology, carpentering and masonry, as part of the administration's empowerment effort. For more, I reached Thesele Maseribani shortly after he presented his budget to Parliament in Lesotho's capital, Maseru.
I was putting a request to Parliament to give me 2022-23 budget for the Ministry of Small Business, Marketing and Cooperatives of Lesotho. In total, as you can see, it is just 144-250 million to run the ministry. Who is in charge of Lesotho Industrialization Center, which is a center where the dropouts from standard 7 or grade 7, the dropouts in the high school or secondary, or ordinary Basotho young and women who are young, are being given a training into bricklaying, plastering, carpentry and joinery, electrical installation and solar. We also want, including metalwork, we also want to put in the digitalization education inside the Lesotho Opportunities Industrialization Center.
With a lot of countries facing financial challenges, particularly due to the global coronavirus pandemic, do you think Lesotho would have the money that you seek?
Well, there are activities that are giving us hope that African Development Bank is playing a role into promoting entrepreneurship. We also have the World Bank that is supporting the Basotho Enterprise Development Corporation mandate. So they are, it's not only coming from the budget consolidation fund of the government of Lesotho. It is also, part of it is going to be contributed by other development partners around the globe.
Where do you want to take this ministry with this budget that you're asking for? What is your plan?
Well, issues of recurrent, you know, they're used for compensation of employees and travel and transport. Usually, it is administration most of it. Capital, we know that Lesotho is one of those countries that enjoy a lot of water, and especially premium water from Lesotho. We have closed the market, but we want to find an opportunity to grow our water sector in Lesotho to promote business, small business into very strong, viable business into water bottling in Lesotho. We also like to add more numbers into the BEDCO incubation, where we add more of the youth into innovation, where they come with their products, so that we help the economy of Lesotho. We like to export part of our organic products that we see a lot of corporations, we see cooperatives into farming, now engaging themselves into organic farming. So why I would like to take this ministry with this budget is to find a proper policy that I'm engaged on with a consultant that will enable Basotho to have access to finance and grow the small and micro business into big business in certain areas. That's where I would like to take this ministry in terms of legal framework, in terms of policy development, in terms of incubation centers, into smart partnerships with huge businesses. That's where I would like to take this ministry to.
Now, so how beneficial will this be for the youth of Lesotho?
The issue of beneficiation is that in the incubation programs, we would have to have a data where we collect in every district per gender to understand, especially what is in the district, what are the expertise, what can be encouraged. Look, our fisheries in Lesotho can be one of the most exported products. We can start eating fish. We've never been fish eaters as Basotho, but we've got a huge opportunity which has not been utilized for a long time. We are exporting our trout to Japan. So it is very important to start encouraging, having platforms where we share, where we listen to what the young people are saying, especially in this IT sector. There are so many IT entrepreneurs today in Lesotho. So data is very important.
Tesele Masribane is the Lesotho Minister for Small Business, Cooperatives and Marketing. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. Amnesty International says the Zimbabwean government is implicated in the deaths of several citizens over the past year, as well as abuses against hundreds of its critics. For VOA, Adi Gondo gives us more from Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
The human rights group Amnesty International's latest report on global rights abuses alleges that at least 10 Zimbabweans died at the hands of their government over the past year. The report released recently also says thousands of Zimbabweans, including protesters, were arbitrarily arrested and detained under the pretext of enforcing COVID-19 measures. The Amnesty report accuses President Emmerson Mnangagwa of unleashing state security agents on journalists, human rights defenders, and critics. Among the dead, Amnesty listed Endach Waya and Paul Munakopa, a Bulawayo man police shot. The report also says Vegani Moyo from Silobela, Levison Moyo from Bulawayo, and Mazwi Ndlovu were murdered by suspected ZANU-PF supporters for asking why opposition supporters were being denied access to COVID-19 aid. The report lists what Amnesty calls the abductions and torture of student Tawanda Mcheiwa, who was accused of organizing protests, as well as MDC Alliance activists Joanna Mamombe, Cecilia Chimbiri, and Netsai Marova. It also alleges that government operatives kidnapped and sexually assaulted Notkolo Maposa when they were searching for her uncle, an MDC Alliance member. The report also said the government has arrested and harassed journalists Opo Nchungono and Duduzi Matutu. The report called the state of the world's human rights spans 149 countries, including 35 in sub-Saharan Africa. The report alleges that Zimbabwe's government used the COVID-19 pandemic as an excuse to clamp down on dissenting voices and carry out human rights violations. Rights activist Efinuwe is among those who say pandemic restrictions were used as a cover for abuses.
How else do you stop a society from knowing the true situation than to take out the eyes and ears of society, that is journalists and human rights defenders? And that's what they've been. They have made it a point that the human rights defenders do not have the freedom to operate.
Human rights activist Farai Magu with the Center for Natural Resource Governance, CNRG, says many people were punished for violating restrictions as they tried to earn a living.
The police and military, I think they were very overzealous. People were tortured literally in the streets. They were punished in the streets. There was no due process of the law. And most of them, because they live on hand to mouth, it was very difficult for them to just sit at home and die of hunger. And the government did not do anything to cushion the people from starvation.
The government has not publicly commented about the Amnesty International allegations, and government spokesman Nick Mangwana did not respond to a request for comment. In the past, however, the government has defended security forces against accusations of abuses and has denied allegations that it has encouraged and carried out violence against critics. The government also maintains that it is ensuring compliance with regulations to keep the pandemic. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. But first, in Cameroon, the Northwest and Southwest Women's Task Force is calling on the international community to take concrete steps to pressure the warring factions to stop the conflict in the Central African country. This following the civil society group's week-long social media campaign to highlight what it says are the escalating human rights abuses. The group warns that failure to take punitive actions against leaders of the conflict, including senior government officials, will worsen the humanitarian situation. Human rights groups say the ongoing conflict in the mainly English-speaking parts of the country has left over 3,000 people dead and over 1 million displaced from their homes. Sally Mbumien is the leader of the Northwest and Southwest Women's Task Force. She tells me that stiff sanctions imposed on the leaders of the conflict can play a key role in ending the fighting in Cameroon.
We remember that the international bodies like the U.S. Senate, there are different calls from different angles. There's Britain that has said something, there is Canada, and all of these international bodies. Yeah, we appreciate the strong condemnations, but our campaign now is calling them, is coming out to call all actors, all world state men and state ladies, to carry out concrete action in resolving the problem in the Northwest and Southwest regions. The humanitarian concerns and the risk of an escalation in violence, although the situation is very bad, is very imminent. We are calling on this party, this campaign is aimed at calling on these powers to be able to take concrete actions, not by just giving words of mouth, but by supporting, either by offering resources, meeting out sanctions if need be, calling out parties in conflict in Cameroon to have an inclusive dialogue, carry out a peace negotiation, talk to each other, for the population of the Northwest and Southwest have been grossly neglected and the people are dying in silence.
Apart from the measures that you talked about, what other tools can the international community use, including those in the region, take in order to ensure that the call that you seek for an inclusive dialogue will materialize?
The kinds of actions that they can take is economic sanctions. They can ban the sales of arms or arms and proliferation of arms in Cameroon. They can equally go ahead to put a fact-finding mission to come to Cameroon and get the facts straight and listen and start putting the process together. They can equally decide to carry out different dialogue sessions with different parties involved in the conflict so that they can be this understanding on which best approach they can take to be able to solve the current situation.
Sally, why do you think both sides have been so far reluctant to engage each other in the dialogue you seek? There appears to be a lot of suspicions and counter-accusations among the two warring factions.
These differences has gone up because the fact that the conflict is gradually graduating into a show of power, a tussle to show who is great, who is in control, rather than seeking for good governance and good life for the citizens. So this confusion has stayed on because it is a question of who is going to bend down. The main issue that we have amongst this our community that is causing confusion is having an agreement on how to end violence, because the common ground is all factions condemns the violence that we experience as a people. That's why they conveniently blame and accuse each other for being the source of it. But they are undecided on which approach to take. That is why we are suggesting that for the factions, we should use international norms and instruments to call them to actions so that they can be accountable and take responsibility for their different stance.
What do you think are the prospects of this social media push seeking to end this ongoing conflict, Sally?
This social media push that we are doing today will not even be a one-time action. We will continue to hold on to it. Our prospect is to get the parties involved, the people who can help us resolve or push the parties to resolve the conflict, to respond to us. Remember, access in a regular space is usually limited to grassroots organizations and civil society actions like we are carrying out. It is our belief that talking to these people who deliberate about these issues in high places, they are going to respond to us. We are just holding them by the words they have used. We are building on the declarations and the strong statements they have made towards building the culture of peace in our communities. We believe that through this campaign, we are going to continue to get these people remain conscious of our challenge, because the silence at the international scene is giving us the signal that they believe all is well.
Sally Mbomien is the leader of the Northwest and Southwest Women's Task Force. She spoke with me from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé. Meanwhile, about 60 former fighters and civilians rescued from Boko Haram by Nigerian, Chadian and Cameroonian troops have been rushed to a disarmament, demobilization and reintegration center in northern Cameroon. Most of the civilians are women and children, some with fresh scars and amputated body parts, an indication of torture by the terror group. For VOA Moki, Edward Kenzeka reports from Maroua on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria and Chad.
35 children, 12 men and 11 women, most of them looking exhausted, rush for food and water at the Disarmament, Demobilization and Reintegration Center in Meri, a Cameroonian town on the border with Nigeria and Chad. Among them is 29-year-old Momeni Sadauma. Sadauma said she was abducted from the Cameroon border village of Amchide in July 2014 and taken to Nigeria's Borno State. The United Nations says Borno State is an epicenter of the Nigerian terrorist Boko Haram. Sadauma said she does not know the fathers of the two children she delivered in the bush in the Nigerian town of Banki. Boko Haram fighters sexually abuse girls and women and refuse to provide water and food for the women and their children, she told VOA. She is grateful to God for saving her life and the lives of her two children, Sadauma said, from the heartless armed men who abducted her and took her to Nigeria. Cameroon said Thursday the multinational joint task force of the Lake Chad Basin Commission freed civilians from the terrorist group. The task force, based in the Chadian capital of N'Djamena, is made up of troops from Benin, Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Nigeria. Omar Bishai, coordinator of the Disarmament, Demobilization and Reintegration Center in Meri, says 11 of those sent there are Boko Haram fighters who disarmed and surrendered to the military. He said some of the former fighters and civilians had wounds and amputations, indicating they were tortured in Boko Haram captivity.
Leur édition s'est déroulée de plusieurs façons, notamment à travers.
He says troops from Cameroon, Chad, and Nigeria jointly launched rescue operations along the borders and saved the civilians from Boko Haram atrocities. He says during the rescue operations, some Boko Haram fighters who were disgruntled and wanted to surrender, dropped their weapons. Bishai said some of the rescued mothers said they were sexually assaulted by terrorist fighters. He said most of the 35 rescued children, ranging from 6 months to 9 years, do not know their fathers. Social workers have been sent by the government of Cameroon to take care of the women and children. Habiba Mama of Cameroon's Social Affairs Ministry says she wants the civilians to first of all express their concerns and worries.
selon les situations qui se présentent à nous dans le cadre de travail d'accompagnement psychosocial.
She says social workers must pay special attention to each victim because the rescued women and children have difficult stories to share. She said she listened to stories of victims in distress and there is a need to ensure their psychological well-being before they are reintegrated into society. Cameroon said it will provide psychosocial and economic assistance to those rescued before they return to their communities. In February, Cameroon said 5,000 of the 103,000 Nigerians, mostly women and children, who fled across the border from Boko Haram terrorists had agreed to return to Nigeria. Cameroon said it had agreed with troops from Nigeria and Chad to free civilians still held in captivity by the terror group and make sure Boko Haram's ability to attack is reduced to minimum for peace to return. Boko Haram terrorists have been fighting for 11 years with the aim of creating an Islamic caliphate in northeast Nigeria. The fighting has spread to Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Benin. The United Nations says Boko Haram violence has killed over 30,000 people and displaced about 2 million in Nigeria, Cameroon, Niger, and Chad. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Marwa, Cameroon.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. FIFA has banned Chad from global football until further notice over government interference in the running of the country's football federation. This follows the Minister of Youth and Sports dissolving the Federation of Chad Football Associations in March. After the minister's announcement, the Confederation of African Football disqualified the national team from last month's final two rounds of qualifying for the Africa Cup of Nations. A statement from FIFA says, "The football world's governing body will lift the suspension at any time before the next FIFA Congress takes place." And Egypt's giants, Zamalek, have until the end of April to decide whether to appeal the decision to pay former player Benjamin Achampong over $1 million. FIFA has sent the five-time African champions the reasons why it had instructed the Cairo club to pay the money to the Ghanaian. FIFA's decision last month came after the Court of Arbitration for Sports ruled in December that Zamalek must pay Achampong after determining that the player was forced into breaking his contract by the club's actions. In the African Champions League, Algerian champions CR Belouizdad beat South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns 2-0 to clinch a place in the quarterfinals. It was a kind of revenge for the Algerians, who lost 5-1 to Sundowns in the reverse fixture in February. In Friday's other Group B game, DR Congo's TP Mazembe, who were already out of contention to make the quarterfinals, came from behind to win 2-1 over Sudan's Al Hilal. The Sudanese club had needed a win to have any chance at all of progressing. In athletics, Kenya's Ruth Chepngetich smashed the women's half marathon world record last week in Istanbul. She took half a minute off the previous record of 1 hour, 4 minutes and 31 seconds set by Ethiopia's Abdelbabel Yeshane in February 2020 in the United Arab Emirates. The 26-year-old Chepngetich was followed across the line in Turkey by Ethiopia's Yelamzef Yehlo. Kenya's Helen Obiri came third in 1 hour, 4 minutes and 51 seconds. This was the first time three women have finished inside 65 minutes in one half marathon. World record holder Kibowet Kandi won the men's race in a course record of 59 minutes and 35 seconds. And in boxing, Manny Pacquiao is reportedly in discussions to return to boxing after an absence of nearly 2 years to fight WBO welterweight champion Terence Crawford on June 5th. The 42-year-old Pacquiao would be fighting in a pay-per-view bout in Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. In his most recent fight in July 2019, Pacquiao defeated Keith Thurman to win the WBA welterweight title, making him a 12-time world champion. The 33-year-old Crawford, who was the undisputed junior welterweight champion before moving up a division, last fought in November, knocking out Kell Brook. And that's it for this edition of Netland Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports, Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Believe in love. How crazy it could be, baby, baby. That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Bill Eagle, reporter Douglas Impulver, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a farmer who doesn't work in the rain or under the sun has nothing to harvest at the end of the farming year. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.